Veterans Radio is dedicated to all the men and women who have served or are currently serving in the Armed Forces of the United States of America. Today's Veterans Radio program is brought to you by U.S. Wings, the Marine Scholars Program at Ave Maria University.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Yeah, welcome to another Veterans Radio program. Here we are at the beginning of a new year, 2012. And with me is my partner, helicopter pilot, 195th Assault Helicopter Group. I'm getting it. The Ghost Riders. Okay.
He's working on it. He's getting it.
Well, I'm another year older, you know. They talk about how you lose your short-term memory. Well, you know. But my partner, of course, it's Dale Thronberry. Dale.
Good morning, Bob, and welcome to all of you out there listening to Veterans Radio on your local station or on the Internet. I just wanted to say hi to Alan Woods down in Australia.
Hi, mate.
Yes, there he is. And
have that Foster.
Yeah, well, he sent us a nice Christmas card, and I wanted
He would have sent us a Foster, you know.
Let's remember. You know, yes. Anyway, thanks, Alan, for the card, and we're looking forward to seeing you hopefully at the anniversary of the Vietnam Wall in November this year. It's going to be the 30th anniversary of the dedication of the Vietnam Memorial. And it looks like people are coming from all over the world.
All over the world. Boy, that's going to be a big event. What if we could broadcast live from
I think it's something that we should look into.
Absolutely.
It's going to be a major event, of course, for those of us that served in Vietnam and also for the country. And, well, we're very honored that we got invited. So
and
we're going to go.
And it's all part of the healing.
It is. Well, you know, it takes a long time.
Long time.
You know, we never understood this about our parents. That had served in World War II, we figured, well, you know, they came home, they got over it. No, they never did.
No.
Who was it we were talking to this morning somewhere? There's a 100-year-old man that comes to the restaurant, the big boy restaurant that we go to every Saturday morning. 100-year-old, wounded 4 times during World War II. Still around. He was talking about, another guy who was 90 years old. Oh, the kid.
The kid. Today's program started out as a conversation with Bob Crudy, and I know Bob's listening from U.S. Wings. We were down there in May into the 50th rally, the 50th anniversary rally for Vietnam. And Bob is a aficionado of Air Force, of airplanes and stories, and he talked about the interception of Admiral Yamamoto and the P-38 airplane. And what those pilots, what those guys, they only had a handheld compass and a watch and a map. That was it. You know, there was no GPS, there was no satellites, and plus they had to steer the darn thing.
Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a great story. I'm looking forward to hearing this story today.
That just intrigued me so much that... And so when we do see those World War II guys, and now they're a little, they've got their, maybe their walker, and they got gray hair, but we like to tell these stories on Veterans Radio because it brings it back. It brings it back to the courage, the dedication, the intelligence, the integrity, how they did that, how they flew over open ocean at 30 feet. You and I were talking this morning at 50 feet, and I'm looking here at the facts, it was 30 feet. That's not even the height of a semi. On the waves, wave hopping, and they had to navigate and steer. Wow.
Yeah, and calculate their fuel consumption and calculate their airspeed. I mean, all this higher math that nobody really realizes that you need to do in order to get, you know. Remember those old math questions? The math questions. If a train leaves from Chicago at 20 miles an hour and one leaves from Detroit, when do they hit? Well, this is stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
All the time.
And they did it. Wow, what a story. And we do have, as our guest today, Dr. Rebecca Grant from IRIS, a research group out of Washington. We'll be with Dr. Grant in a moment. So is there anything else that we need to clear up? Go Blue. I had to get that in, folks. Yeah, that's right.
Well, and we're hoping that the Hawaiian Blue goes well this evening, so we'll talk about that.
Oh, that's right, the Honolulu.
Honolulu Blue.
Honolulu Blue, we have to get that in. Okay, you're listening to Veterans Radio. In a moment, we'll be right back with Operation Vengeance and Dr. Rebecca Grant.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
That is the theme from the Army Air Force, the 8th Air Force, before it was a separate service branch of the Air Force, which is off. You can see that little, you know, that all kind of gets in there. So that was the beginning of the Air Force, the Army 8th Air Corps. There we go. Today's program, Operation Vengeance. It was carried out to kill Japanese Admiral Iso Roku Yamamoto, the commander of the combined fleet of the Imperial Japanese Navy. And with me today is Dr. Rebecca Grant, president of IRIS Independent Research, a public policy research organization located in Washington, D.C., where most of the stuff is located today with all what's happening going on. Dr. Grant earned her Ph.D. in international relations from the London School of Economics, worked for RAND and the offices of the Secretary of the Air Force and Chief of Staff of the Air Force. In 1995, she founded IRIS Independent Research, performing work on strategic planning for aerospace and government clients. Recent studies that she has concluded for the Air Force have included analysis of major campaigns from Kosovo to Afghanistan and Iraq, evaluation of air-based ground defense concepts. Boy, that'll be interesting sometime in the future to talk to her about that. And research on long-range strike. And she's also involved with shaping operations for Fleet Forces Command, a study of carrier aviation concepts. What a change from where it was not even 100 years ago when Billy Mitchell was talking about carriers, and now it is the power. It's the extension of power. She talks about the roles for the new CVN-78 Ford-class carrier. And other studies included research on J-STARS. Those are missions in Afghanistan, stealth maintenance, and modernization issues, as well as the KCX tanker competition. Wow. Dr. Grant is an active member of the Air Force Association. She writes regularly for Air Force Magazine and has appeared on television as commentator on Air Power. She also serves as a director of the General William Mitchell Institute for Air Power Studies. It's a nonprofit research firm founded by the Air Force Association to promote scholarly research and debate on air power and all its forms in airspace and cyber. Dr. Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Glad to be on the program with you.
Well, we're glad to have you here. By the way, folks,
it's 1943, a group of 18 P-38 Lightning fighters led by a 28-year-old man named Major John Mitchell take off from Guadalcanal. They fly over open water and intercept Admiral Yamamoto, who is flying in a Japanese plane nicknamed Betty. They intercept him at 9:34 in the morning and shoot down his plane. It crash lands. He is killed. And in this, they have taken out the commander of Japan's combined Imperial fleet on direct orders of Yamamoto's U.S. counterpart, Admiral Chester Nimitz, and with approval from Franklin Delano Roosevelt. They have basically killed the architect of Pearl Harbor.
Think of that, folks. Think of what that would be. That would be like somebody going after General Petraeus and taking him out. This was so significant and so huge. Why was that, Dr. Graham? By the way, thank you very much for that. And we will get into details of the mission, folks, later on in the program. But why, for the obvious, for the demise of Admiral Yamamoto, what were some of the other mitigating circumstances?
Yes, well, Yamamoto remains a really unique figure among America's top military opponents. He was the architect of Pearl Harbor. He was very unique in the Japanese Navy of that time, a brilliant strategist, a tremendous poker player, a real believer in science and technology, and he alone of that Japanese high command had the ability to wage the war in the Pacific. Now, Yamamoto knew that Japan's chance of beating America in the long run was pretty slim. So he put together some treacherous but brilliant campaigns in the beginning to try to do everything he could to win the war quickly. So really the beginnings of World War II for America were masterminded by Yamamoto. He was what today we would call a high-value target, but it's almost impossible to overestimate his significance, his impact on Japan's war machine and Japan's war plans. The other interesting thing, Bob, is that the people who planned the mission to kill Yamamoto, the high-level commanders back at Pearl Harbor, like Chester Nimitz and his intelligence officer, Captain Edward Layton, they knew Yamamoto personally. Yamamoto, as a younger officer, had been Japan's naval attaché and had lived in Washington, D.C. in the 1920s. He spoke fluent English, which he had learned as a child from missionaries in Japan. And then several of the staff at Nimitz's command there, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, Chester Nimitz, several of his staff had done assignments in Japan. So Captain Layton had known Yamamoto very well in the 1930s. They had been to the theater together in Japan when Layton was assigned there as an intelligence officer. They'd played cards together. Of more general interest, the Japanese had helped a little bit in 1937 in the search for Amelia Earhart's downed plane. So when they decided to kill Yamamoto, this was not just a person they saw in the newspapers or on the newsreels. So not only was he enemy number one, leading Japan's forces, but he was also someone that they'd known socially and knew very well.
So it'd be like going after an acquaintance.
Absolutely. And more than that, it would be like going after someone that you had
played poker with.
Your social circle, that you literally played cards with. You know, in those days, they play a lot of bridge, game that went on and on. You'd been out to the theater with them. You'd been out drinking scotch, probably even visiting the geisha districts of Tokyo.
Yeah. I did read his bio, and it did say he liked the ladies. Yes, he did.
Yes, yes, he did. They called him Mr. 80 Cents because he was two fingers on one hand.
Yeah, two fingers.
Tremendously interesting figure. Yeah. But, you know, there's a reason that they called this Operation Vengeance. We probably think of vengeance and revenge for Pearl Harbor, and there was a lot of that there. Of course, course, what they were really trying to do was cut off the head, the thinking part of the Japanese military forces in the Pacific, and they did that. But April 1943 is the thick of the war in the Pacific. And the reason that Yamamoto was there, down in the area, down in the Solomon Islands area, and not back in Tokyo, was that he was on an inspection tour. And he was there also to try to boost the morale of Japanese forces. If I can just roll you back a little bit in history, of course, Japan had held the island of Guadalcanal, and they wanted to build a bomber base there so that they could control more of the sea lines to Australia. The U.S. was using Australia. Of course, Australia was fighting heavily in this war as an ally, and those were key supply lines. So when Guadalcanal was invaded in August of 1942, the reason was to stop Japan building the bomber strip there. Of course, we all know about the famous just hand-to-hand fighting that went on in Guadalcanal. The air combat just as fierce. The Navy actually lost several battles to Japan in and around the Solomon Islands and the slot in the fall of 42. So by early 43, they have the Japanese on the run in this area, and Yamamoto decides that they need to make one more all-out push to try to knock down the American presence and the foothold that they've gained on Guadalcanal. So the reason that Yamamoto was there was to literally stand on the runway and wave at some of the pilots as they went by, and they had just a little bit prior to the shootdown tried an all-out attack on Guadalcanal, which failed. They actually lost probably more aircraft than they should have, and it wasn't a success. But he had gone down to try to spur that on, and that's why he was touring what was really the front lines at that point.
Mm-hmm. No, I was asking about, because we've done a number of stories about that whole area, about Rabaul, I think it's Rabaul, is
Rabaul,
that it?
Mm-hmm.
And Bougainville, mm-hmm. and so forth. And it's just fascinating when you find out that he was there. My question to you, Dr. Clark, was how this man is so amazing in that he was so much in favor of the modernization of the Japanese Navy, along with his counterparts, on our side, that said, this is where the battle is going to take place. It's going to take place at sea, and with the ships and planes, and that was a totally new concept. It seemed like.
And something else, too, that it had been mentioned that he said that he was going to march down Pennsylvania Avenue right up to the White House and ask the president for his surrender. Now, I don't know how true that is. Dr. Grant, do you know anything about that? Was that something that you had read?
I don't know about that specifically, but make no mistake, Japan was really all in on this one, and Yamamoto had great respect for the United States, but there's no question that when it came to it, he really wanted to defeat the U.S. and win the war for Japan. So I think that accurately captures the sentiment.
Yeah, and at the conclusion of our program today, we will discuss some of the pilots that were involved in the actual shootdown. And one of the things that the pilot did say on returning back to base at Guadalcanal was, that bastard won't be knocking on the White House door now, which we'll talk about why that was such a no-no at that moment. But going on, now, Yamamoto, what they did know about him was that he was a person that stuck to detail, and he was a stickler to having a schedule. If he said he was going to leave, and all the dispatches show that at a certain time he made that itinerary. It wasn't 10 minutes early or 10 minutes later. What it was right on, and that's what the Americans used to help calculate where they would intercept the bombers that were carrying Yamamoto and his staff. Want to tell us a little bit about that, Dr. Grant?
That's right, Bob. And it's an interesting thing here, because what happens is on April 13th, the code breakers at up at Pearl Harbor pick up Yamamoto's itinerary. And it says, 0600 takeoff, and it runs down his whole itinerary for April 18th. It's an incredible piece of intelligence and a real lapse on Japan's part, but it was a great pickup. It was an operational code that they'd actually been using for months, so it was pretty easy for the Navy to crack that code. They immediately passed it around both Nimitz's office and then down to their forward forces at Guadalcanal to try to decide what they could do, and made the decision to go ahead. But what's sort of interesting here is this was a pilot planning out the route, and pilots are very precise. If they say they'll be over the target at 0934, that's when they'll be over the target, 0934. So all the airmen planning knew that they could count on that takeoff time and calculate the route and be pretty sure about when he would show up. So that's what they did. They, as the story has it, the real question was whether they had aircraft that could fly far enough to make the intercept. And with the P-38 Lightning, that was the aircraft that they had there on Guadalcanal, and they knew they could do it. They had to add what they call drop tanks. The aircraft they had were P-38Gs. They made several different models during the war, all of them excellent planes. And the G carried, seems amazing, carried about 300 gallons of gas internally. It's not a lot. But the drop tanks would add another 165 gallons apiece. So that really extended their range. And they needed to do that because they did decide to fly at low level for several reasons. And their fuel consumption at low level is higher. Plus, they need some time in the target area. They need fuel to get home. And they need fuel for the fight with the Japanese Zero fighters that they know will happen.
So they did know that.
They knew that.
But I thought just for stealth that he might have flown unprotected just for stealth so that he wouldn't be recognized. But, okay, you clarified that. Dr. Grant, Dale has a question. He was a pilot, and you wanted to comment on that, on about fuel consumption and...
Well, I think what's so interesting with this, Dr. Grant, is the idea that the coordination between the services is what I find fascinating with this, and also the timeline of how they first intercepted the message and when they get this mission going.
One day, wasn't it?
Yeah. Could you kind of explain the coordination with the different services? That's what I found interesting.
Yes, and, Guadalcanal is really what we call today a joint operation, and it did very well at this, and it was thriving in this time period. So, this part of the campaign was sort of in the split area. Nimitz was running the Central Pacific, and MacArthur was running the Southwest the operations down there in New Guinea, which were pretty active. But the primary commander here was an admiral named Mark Mitcher, and he was in command of air in the Solomon Islands. And from the beginning on Guadalcanal, there had been Army Air Forces aircraft, of course the Marines very famously there as well. And so there was really none of this, Army versus Navy, standoffishness, whatever. They were a real up-and-running joint operation. So when they got the itinerary, they immediately, they had radio communications really globally in that time frame. They were able to pass this information down the Guadalcanal and got everybody together in a tent to plan out what they would be able to do. And they turned to a man named John Mitchell. He was about 28 years old at this time, but an extremely experienced pilot. In fact, all these P-38 pilots were very experienced. They had were right in the thick of the combat with the raid that I mentioned that Japan had just launched. Mitchell himself is a good example. He had been by this time in the Pacific for about a year flying different types of aircraft. He'd been on Guadalcanal for 9 months. So there wasn't much these gentlemen didn't know. Mitchell was probably a little older than the average, but at 28, he was in the prime of his years as a fighter pilot. And this gave them a lot of advantages. One, they were able to plan the mission. They really knew this area. They frequently flew up the Solomon's Chain, which was nicknamed the SWAT. You know, there's an island at the bottom, and Bougainville, where Yamamoto would be flying, was up at the top. The U.S. had Guadalcanal, but the Japanese had most of the other islands heading up there. It's very narrow, an area that the Navy did not like to put their carriers in there because of the threats from Japanese land-based air and Japanese Navy. So really a hot battle zone. But Mitchell and his compatriots knew the area extremely well, and so they knew what they had to do in order to navigate up. And interestingly, you know, Bob talks about the navigation being such a fascinating feature of this. You know, today you get a lat longs and your GPS constellation, which has been running now for for about 15 years, could just guide you right to the spot. But what Mitchell had to do was do it by compass and by dead reckoning.
Wow, and they were just kids. They were just kids. Draw some links.
But they were kids who had been fighting to the death daily for months. So they were some pretty fierce warriors.
Oh, yeah. Hot shot pilots, too.
43, yeah.
Sort of like Pappy Boynton, right? You know, when they talk about
that's
him.
Right.
That's right.
That's right. That was very much in that era. Now, Mitchell did something interesting. He asked... obviously for the drop tanks to go on. Mm-hmm. And so the ground crews got out the welding torches and got to work on those. And he asked for a Navy wet compass.
What is a Navy wet compass?
With a Navy wet compass. Well, this would have been, so the P-38 would have had a magnetic compass on its tiny instrument control panel. In its tiny cockpit.
Right.
But the Navy wet compass is a compass that rests in some kind of a fluid or an oil, a handheld. And the oil damps down the oscillation of the needle. So the magnetic compass in the P-38 might have wiggled or spun if there was interference. This Navy wet compass was a much truer and more accurate guide. But it was still just a compass. So they had to be able to navigate off the bearings. But Mitchell was asked for and got a good Navy wet compass to use to make sure his navigation was spot on as they flew up the slot towards the rendezvous at Bougainville.
Okay, I'm going back in time now and remembering our little magnetic compasses we had in a Huey that would, you know, would spin sometimes when you're trying to follow it. It wasn't that accurate. And what I'm envisioning is kind of a mini compass of like they had on the ships that was floating horizontally instead of vertically, almost. Is that kind of an idea of a picture?
That's exactly it, Dale, and that's what Major John Mitchell was worried about. He was worried about that compass spinning at the wrong moment, and so what they gave him was a real solid hold-in-the-hand Navy wet compass.
All right.
He wondered where they got it from, but somehow they got it there on Guadalcanal, and he had that with him. The other advantage he had was, again, they knew the terrain. So flying low in this case, I think, actually helped them with the navigation. And as a helicopter pilot, you certainly understand that. As the terrain, yes, they've been up and down this slot, starts to look familiar, and that assists them with their navigation as well, especially given that they were doing some open water flying. And being down lower meant they weren't going to miss, one of the islands, Choiseul or one of the others as they flew by. So low altitude actually probably helped them with the navigation.
And also, folks, we have to remember that they had to fly the darn thing, too, at the same time, have a map, two hands, three different objects. Wow. We're going to get right back to our story in just a moment after this very short break for the Medal of Honor. And our bump music, and then we're going to be right back at Veterans Radio, so don't go away.
He manned a hose to cool hot armed bombs rolling dangerously on the listing deck, continuing his efforts despite searing, suffocating smoke which forced men to fall back gasping. O'Callaghan inspired the officers and men of the Franklin to fight heroically and with profound faith in the face of almost certain death and to return their stricken ship to port. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Yeah, that's the Army, right? Yeah, the caissons go rolling along, right? So that was a very abbreviated Medal of Honor.
With, you know, technology sometimes hasn't improved that much in 70 years.
Yeah, right here at WDEO. We're talking with Dr. Rebecca Grant, and she's going over the P-38 mission to eliminate Isoroku Yamamoto. And getting back, now, Dr. Grant, we were talking about the P-38. Draw some links between that and the F-22 today.
Oh, there's a wonderful lineage from the P-38 to both the F-22 and the even newer F-35 fighters. And that lineage begins with one man, Clarence Kelly Johnson. Kelly Johnson was an engineer, and he helped design the P-38 for the Lockheed Aircraft Company. He later went on to design the U-2, one of the first jets, the P-80. He's really one of the most famous aircraft designers. And the lineage is that it was Kelly Johnson who set up the Lockheed Skunk Works. And, of course, it's the Skunk Works who designed the F-22 as part of the now larger Lockheed Martin Corporation. F-22 first flew in demonstrator in 1991, and then the F-35, which is a stealth fighter being produced for the Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps, is actually nicknamed the Lightning II. The Lightning was a P-38's nickname, and the F-35 stealth fighter has been nicknamed Lightning II in homage to the P-38. So it's a direct bloodlines from Kelly Johnson and the P-38 right up to America's top fighters today, the top stealth fighters, F-22 and F-35.
Well, now that sets the stage and the scenario. Now we're up to that day, and this is what we've been waiting for. How did they do it?
How did they do it? Well, first, they had to have breakfast. Probably
steak and eggs. Oh, that was supposed to be true.
Well, it's hard to say. There are different accounts about what they ate. Some say they got the good meal before, like you say, Bob, and some say they got that good meal when they landed. Either way, you know, you wonder how much of it really tasted good down there in the heat of Guadalcanal. But they had their modified drop tanks, and as usual with operations, as Bob and Dale, you know as well, things went wrong from the beginning. Mm-hmm. One of the P-38s blew a tire on takeoff, and another had trouble with its drop tank. So after they launched 18, tried to launch 18, they were pretty quickly down to 16 P-38s. And then they proceeded up from Guadalcanal. They actually arced out a little ways from the island chain. I'm looking here at an old globe showing the slot. And going up from Guadalcanal towards their objective, or Bougainville, where Yamamoto's plane would be. The globe belonged actually to my father, who was a World War II Navy vet, now passed away, but I think of him with this globe. So they flew up from Guadalcanal, and they had allowed actually a little extra time, and it was just as well they did, because Yamamoto's planes were there just as they arrived in the area. I think they sort of planned that they would maybe have a bit of time to circle. They went up to slightly higher altitude, pulled up to about 3,000 feet, and there they were. And everyone agrees the man who spotted the planes was one of the pilots, also extremely experienced, named Doug Canning. So they're from the 70th Squadron. So... but again, problems happen, and there were some problems with the drop tanks. They had planned that six aircraft would go in to attack the two Bettys, the one carrying Admiral Yamamoto, the other carrying other senior officers and staff. And two of the planes that scheduled to go in couldn't drop their tanks, and that meant they couldn't take part in the fight. So they brought in two more. That's why they had a big group there to give cover for the Zeros. They knew would attack, and also it was spares. And they bore right in. And at this point, the P-38s are up at about 3,000 feet. The Bettys are sort of hugging the coast, if you will. And they see them. And, of course, they also see Zeros in the area. So this group splits off. You know, they drop their tanks. They leap up a bit, and then the killer flight goes in.
This is the kill group.
That's right. And, of course, as you know, it all happens so quickly. Mm-hmm. So going in the killer group, that's what you call it, the killer flight, are Lanfear, Barber, Holmes, Hines, some others from the 70th, and they're trying to get in through about six Zeros that are escorting these bombers and get to the bombers. Now, they're lucky to be in the P-38, and here's why. The P-38 had nose-mounted guns. It was unusual. Most of the fighters in those days had guns in the wings, and that gave them great converging fire, but because of the nose-mounted guns, the P-38 could fire accurately from about 1,000 yards compared to more like 200 or 300 yards for other fighters of the day. So they go in, and they blast away at these bombers, and they hit them. They hit them right away, and down they go. One crashes on land, and the other goes into the sea.
Well, and part of this, folks, you have to keep in mind that stealth had to be maintained. The reason that they did the circuitous route was to not give the Japanese the idea at all that this had been pre-planned. It was supposed to be, hey, we stumbled onto this, we shot him, we saw the enemy, and we shot him out of the sky, and that was it. It was to maintain the fact that we had broken the Japanese code. So they got in. And did they have to circle the wreckage to make sure that he was, or that both of the bombers were definitely crashed, and the one on land, did they circle it all to...
No, nobody had time to do any circling. There were way too many, way too much else going on, way too many Zeros in the area, way too dangerous. So the crash was pretty well seen. And, you know, by this time, so you've got the killer flight that started out, and they've gone in, but by the time they make their shooting pass, essentially, you know, they're down lower than they really want to be. You know, altitude is life back in those days. And they've just flown through several Zeros. Some of the other P-38s are off tangling with the Zeros. And, you know, they're not very far away. I mean, they put, you know... Rex Barber, you know, is one who goes after the attack, and he claims he puts three bursts into this into the Betty, into the bomber that's carrying Yamamoto. So there, everyone's watching this, and pieces of the engine cowling are flying off. Bomber catches on fire, and they see it going down. So they, again, experienced pilots, they know that Betty carrying Yamamoto is done for. It's going to crash. And at that point, what they have to think about is getting out, getting away from the Zeros, and making a turn for home.
Now, there was the bulk of that flight. We're flying at 10,000 feet, correct? With covering fire, did they meet a lot of the Zeros coming up to fight the P-38s?
Right, they had gone up higher, and yes, a dogfight takes place. And as usual in a dogfight, you know, people get separated, and there's a lot going on, and then the key at the end is to rendezvous and is to head for home. So they didn't take much time to wait and circle. And in the end, there are two pilots who claim the kill. They're actually more than that. The entire killer flight gets in some shots at the two aircraft, but there really are two, Lanfear and Barber, who claim it. And in the end, yeah, there's a long story with what happened. In the end, actually many, many years later, the Air Force decides that it's correct to have them share the credit for the kill.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lanfear, on his return to Guadalcanal, what does he say? He's supposed to maintain radio silence. He said, we got that bastard. He's not going to be walking down Pennsylvania Avenue and knocking on the door of the president, which, of course, just blew the whole thing. How were they to know that they just shot down Yamamoto? Had anybody been listening on the Japanese side would have known that we had broken the code. What happened at that point? Were they aghast at the fact that he said that over the air?
I think there was such euphoria, and, you know, they also had some things to deal with. They lost one of the killer flights, was shot down, didn't make it home. He wasn't as experienced in the P-38, evidently. And another of the shooters in the killer flight had taken some damage and had gone down for an emergency landing at an unfinished airstrip on the Russell Islands. So there was a lot going on, but definitely the euphoria over that. And it's interesting, the message that went back to Pearl Harbor was very circumspect. And it just mentioned the planes being shot down. There was no mention of Yamamoto's name. Of course, Nimitz knew what had happened and looks at it and he says, well, it looks like we bagged a peacock.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was like winning a major battle. To take this person out.
Exactly, Bob. And he notes in his log that it was a big secret, and they had to wait until May 21st when Japan announced the death of Yamamoto. So there was a long gap. More than a month went by until anyone could say anything at all about the mission, and of course, decades before there was discussion of the code breaking.
When did the Japanese become aware that we had broken their code? Any idea?
You know, the whole code breaking story, there was a lot of back and forth and suspicion, but I don't think they were aware of the extent of the penetration during the war, because they did not change the codes rapidly enough. And there were some codes that were always very difficult to crack, some of the higher-level operational codes. There were others that were easier to deal with. And, of course, every time they changed a code book, they reasonably assumed, okay, now we've got it locked away. So it was a constant back-and-forth battle. And there were many different types of codes involved. But Navy intelligence always had some penetration of the Japanese operational or command codes throughout the Pacific War.
Dale, do you have anything?
This is why we did these stories.
They had a 10-minute window to make this thing happen.
And threw it all together in 3 days.
And did it in 3 days.
And I think that's what's amazing. And the idea of the aftermath of not reporting, of course, we know how that goes even today, of what actually happened, not coming out, as Dr. Grant points out, you know, for decades, really. And in fact, in reading about this last night, is that they'd finally decided that both of the pilots would share in the responsibility, or the credit, wasn't until 2000 and something, wasn't that it?
That's right. It became a case that was adjudicated by the Air Force, by Secretary Donald Rice in the early 90s, and then the Air Force has a group called the Board for the Correction of Military Records, and they again adjudicated it in the 2000s. But I think, you know, one of the pilots said, you know, no one on God's green earth will know whose bullet it was. But they all knew they had accomplished the mission, and to my mind, one who should get more credit is Major John Mitchell, who planned and led this raid, picked the right people, made sure the drop tanks were there, asked for the Navy wet compass, and planned the route that got them to the intercept point.
Dr. Grant, we have to go to our third break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Check it out. It's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy?
Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
On the way to your college degree, you've hit some roadblocks. You decide it's time to change direction. The Air Force can help. We offer educational assistance, high-tech job training, and experience. The credits you've earned may help you start your Air Force career at a higher rank, and we'll pay off your student loans up to $10,000 if you qualify. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio right here. We're talking about Operation Vengeance. And, wait a minute.
You're changing the format.
I am. I'm just so involved in the story. So why don't we just continue on with the story at this point?
Okay.
Dr. Grant, we did have a question from a listener, and it happens to be Mr. Dwight Zimmerman, who is an author, and he's in Brooklyn, New York. He happens to be doing some research on World War II. Dwight, welcome to Veterans Radio. You have some questions for Dr. Grant.
Yes, I've been enjoying this story here, and it's helping direct some of my research. I'm presently involved in going through the New York Times archives of World War II and preparing a book that is going to be their history of it. And this story about Yamamoto's, the mission to take him down is obviously a pivotal event. Dr. Grant, I appreciate if you could confirm something for me. I seem to recall that the Navy, in gratitude, awarded Barber the Navy Cross. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Zimmerman, you're right about that. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
But that's correct, and that goes back to the fact that that at that time, the Navy was the overall commander in the Solomons area. They had Com Air Sols, as they abbreviated it. So, yes, that's right. Navy Crosses were awarded for that.
Yes, I thought that was very generous of the Navy. Nice gesture of gratitude.
Dale had mentioned that they all eventually...
Didn't they put Mitchell in for the Medal of Honor at some point, but then they ended up giving all of the pilots, I think it was a Silver Star or something along those lines? Dr. Grant?
Yeah, that may well be. It seems, while a terrific raid, it doesn't strike me as meeting the Medal of Honor criteria. But Navy Cross, absolutely, and things that celebrate their flying achievement. And so there were very few Army flyers in World War II awarded the Navy Cross. So these guys really did something special to get it. And I think it shows how well the Army and the Navy could work together when the chips were down, when they were really in the thick of the fight and in extremis. It was a really fantastic cooperation there on Guadalcanal.
Dwight, do you have any other questions?
That was the key one. As I said, I was very much enjoying this, and I want to thank you for this adding to my knowledge of this story. It has always been a fascinating one for me, and I knew a little bit about it, obviously, but I appreciate Dr. Grant filling in a lot of the blanks.
Good. Well, thank you very much for the call.
Mm-hmm.
God bless.
Bye.
Well, there we go. By the way, if you have a question, 877-753-7825. There we go. I had to get all those sevens in there. Dr. Grant, wow, what a story. And I want to move on, though. President Obama talked about air power and being in the Pacific. Why don't you comment on that?
Yes, President Obama visited the Pentagon this past week with Defense Secretary Panetta and the Joint Chiefs all there and their staff, and he made a short speech and released a new strategy. And if you just read through it, you might not quite catch the significance, but what he said is that Asia will be a priority in our defense planning. And although he didn't say it, part of the implication behind this is that out in the Pacific, our joint forces are really beginning to take seriously the potential threat from China. Now, we know China is a trade partner. We have active economic and diplomatic relations. But the turn to Asia has two sides to it. It's partly about continuing to build our relationships with our terrific allies there, such as Japan, Australia, and many, many others. But it's also about being ready to deter rising Chinese military power. Their forces have become pretty active, and it's part of America's security responsibilities in the Pacific to deter that from growing into something that would threaten us or our allies. So it's a pretty significant speech the president has made in talking about Asia-Pacific regions.
Right. He's talking about the idea of having to build up our forces because China has, their navy is now almost larger than ours as far as ships in that area, and their air power is increasing, and that we need to concentrate more on those parts of our defense rather than actual ground troops, it sounds like. And I know that you're involved in some of your articles I've seen about the different types of aircraft that are being developed. I was fascinated by the idea of the possibly remote-controlled long-range bomber.
I know, but
kind of a super drone.
Are we treading somewhere where we shouldn't be by asking that question?
Oh, not at all. That's being widely discussed in Washington, and both of the Air Force and the Navy are looking at really at two things that come together. One is long-range strike. And for the same reason that confronted Major John Mitchell in April of 1943, there are vast distances in the Pacific. So how do you bring combat power to bear over vast distances? Aircraft carriers do some of that. Our land-based fighters do a lot of that work. But it's a bomber theater. The U.S. has had a rotating but constant bomber presence on Guam for the past 8 years.
B-52
bombers carry that. So remotely piloted, that's because we've had such success over the past decade with remotely piloted reconnaissance and surveillance aircraft like the high-altitude Global Hawk or like the very well-known Predators and Reapers in Afghanistan and Iraq. So it's possible to fly a large aircraft remotely. But right now, I think people are evaluating the tactical and technical trade-offs for doing that in the bomber. And we'll see what they come up with. Certainly it's technologically possible, but it may be better for the mission. Again, I just think about Major John Mitchell and how good it is sometimes to have that really well-trained male or female there in the air crew to make those split-second decisions like Mitchell would have made leading those P-38s up to Bougainville to intercept Admiral Yamamoto.
I know you don't have any gut reactions on a robot. You know, sensation of maybe we should try this. Or
not if you're sitting in a mountain in Nevada or underneath the desert, maybe I could ask this question now that we have the expert on the air, that I was told that the F-22 is going to be the last manned fighter. Is that true?
Oh, let me quote James Bond and never say never. it's not true at the moment because coming along right now in production is the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter named Lightning II in homage to the P-38. So F-22 is the most advanced of our U.S. stealth fighters, the most advanced stealth fighter ever created on the planet. It is really one of a kind. The F-35 has a lot of those features plus others that make it really well suited for reconnaissance and for ground attack. So our plans right now are to buy F-35s in pretty big quantity for the Air Force, for the Navy, the Marine Corps, and several of our international allies, including Japan and other allies like the Royal Air Force and Britain. And so the F-35 will be in production for many, many years to come. What happens after that, 20 or 30 years from now, is anyone's guess.
And I have a question. I was reading your biography, and I noticed that you had a muscle car. You had a muscle car back in the day.
You're
67, Catalina. Your motorcycles and so forth. And, you know, we have this need for speed. And I know this is public knowledge, so I'm always fascinated by this. How fast do these the F-22 and 35s go?
They're pretty fast. The unique thing, and they're different. They're designed differently. F-35 is a Mach-capable fighter, absolutely. The neat thing about F-22 is it has something called Super Cruise. That sounds maybe like something out of a comic strip, but what it means is it means Mach flight, and it's been tested up to 1.6, Mach 1.6, Mach 1.8, without afterburner.
Oh,
I know you can understand, Bobdale, why that's significant, to not light that afterburner, burn the fuel, and show that big hot signature.
Right, yeah, that's sort of like Star Wars when they hit warp speed, you know,
right.
It's gone. But for our civilian audience, what is Mach 1? How fast
Mach
is it?
Mach is the speed of sound at whatever altitude you're at. So that's, you know, depending on where you are, that's maybe 500-600 miles an hour or more. And so this means that the F-22 can go more than 1,000 miles an hour in normal power settings.
I like that. I could be in New Jersey.
That's an amazing achievement.
Well,
faster than my motorcycle, by the way.
Yeah. It's all relevant, right?
Will the F-35 be at the air? It is being produced now, correct?
That's correct. It's first production models are coming out, and it's still in test, being tested at Edwards Air Force Base in California, and also down at Patuxent River, Pax River, here in Maryland.
That's just a question. Will the F-35 be at the air show in Dayton?
I'm not sure as yet. You know, they've got just a few, and they're pretty busy doing tests, all the expansion of the flight envelope. So I'm not sure what their air show schedule is yet. Certainly over the next few years, you should expect to see more F-35s showing up at the air shows. But first they have to get them through test and out to the operational units.
How could you fly 1,000 miles an hour, Dale?
with my reflexes today, it would be really dangerous.
Yes, it would be.
But at 20 years old, I think it would be great. I think it would be the biggest hoot going. I can only imagine what it would feel
gotta like. Gotta be. Dr. Grant, Dr. Rebecca Grant of IRIS Independent Research, want to thank you very much for being on the program. And we'd like to invite you to come back again. I know that there's a slew of topics that we're going to be covering with you. Would you come back to Veterans Radio?
I certainly will. I love to talk about air power, past or present, and I've enjoyed talking with you, Bob and Dale, and Mr. Zimmerman, and thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you much, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Wow. Well, we've only got 30 seconds left, so what do you say?
I'd say that we need to make sure you go to our website and check out U.S. Wings, because U.S. Wings, Ave Maria, and Village Kitchens are sponsoring this program.
Sponsoring
we can't do this
program.
Without them, and thank you all very much for doing that.
Yes. Okay, Dale, well, I hear the theme is coming underneath my voice, so that means we are now getting ready to go out. So until next week, Veterans Radio, you're dismissed.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.